All right, tonight is we begin a new book of the Chumash, the book of Shemot, and the first parsha of Shemot is called Shemot. The title of tonight's class is When Gentiles Save Jews. Okay, very important topic, and we're going to get into that. So we're going to start with a clip from the Academy Award-winning movie Schindler's List. Raise your hand if you've seen Schindler's List. Okay, nearly everybody. Okay. So, Schindler's List, I'm going to, I'll do the basic summary. I'll just read it out. Businessman Oscar Schindler, played outstandingly by Liam Neeson, arrives in Krakow in 1939, ready to make his fortune from World War II, which had just started. After joining the Nazi Party primarily for political expediency, he staffs his factory with Jewish workers for similarly pragmatic reasons. In other words, they were cheaper labor. When the SS begin exterminating Jews in the Krakow ghetto, Schindler arranges to have his workers protected to keep his factory in operation, but soon realized in doing so, he's also saving innocent lives. Schindler ends up saving over 1,200 Jews from Nazi extermination by employing them in his enamelware and munitions factories. He died on the 9th of October, 1974, and is buried in Jerusalem on Mount Zion, the only member of the Nazi Party to be honored in this way. So we're going to see a pivotal point. He goes through an evolution. It's not just he's a prophet-seeking guy. And then he evolves to a mission of saving Jews. And this is where I'll introduce a scene. This is where he was making a list to make the deal with the Nazis about how much he's going to bribe to save this particular list of Jews, his workers who are working in his factories. Let's go, as they say, let us go to the videotape.
No. What's one worth to you?
Ulrich Pfefferberg, Miller Pfefferberg, and Paul Steger,
Doctor.
The investors. I want all of them.
Yes, sir.
Ishmael Fischer. Toshef.
Sharf. Norman, sir. I'm sorry, sir.
Come on, stay on. Sharf. The children. All the children. How many?
400.
I'm doing. You might even make money at it.
I don't know.
Come on, Julius. I know about the extra food and clothes you give them paid for out of your own pocket. If we make a combined approach, we could get more than 4,000 out, mine and yours.
Oscar.
We could relocate them in something like safety in Moravia.
I don't know. How many cigarettes do you smoke tonight?
Too many.
For everyone. You smoke, I smoke half.
But still working for me, I'd expect you to talk me out of it. It's costing me a fortune. Finish the page and leave one space at the bottom.
All right. All right. Okay, so let's get into it. All right, so just for the benefit of those people who did not see the movie, so who was Oskar Schindler? Just give a basic description.
He was a industrialist.
All right, Marvin, then Scott. Go ahead.
He was an opportunist and an industrialist, and he saw an opportunity to make money.
Yes. Okay. Right, and he was a guy, he used big on the bribes. Bribing his way to get the factory, bribing his way to get the cheap labor, and then ultimately when he had a change of heart to protect his workers, he bribed them. Bribed the SS to allow to protect his workers from not being trained to the death camps. So what did he do professionally?
Did he make shells and stuff?
Yes, he did. He made weapons for the war effort for the German army, one. And two, he also made, plates and such.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rabbi, just, I did have the opportunity to go to the concentration camp and see that house from Amnon Goeth, or whatever his name was, the very cruel, sadistic commander of the camp. And if I recall correctly, this was 2005.
What camp was it called?
Plaszno or something like that?
Yes.
Krakow?
Yes, near Krakow, Poland.
The factory was still there when we drove by. MJ had a trip at the time, but I had opted to go with a different group from Rockland County that was going to have a more extensive tour of the area. And so I was with them seeing some of these sites directly, and it was really quite impactful.
I can imagine. Okay, so here now, why did he set up a factory in Poland after the Nazis gained occupation of Poland in 1939? What was his motivation? He had a very simple motivation. Scott?
In the beginning?
In the beginning. He set up a factory there.
He saw, he'd set up a factory and make 100% profit without having to pay the people.
Right, I think they pay him very little, but basically, he could pay his workers. They're cheaper than hiring the Polish workers, and basically near slave labor initially, nearly. And basically, he looked at it as basically a tremendous. Here is free labor, and or near free labor, very inexpensive labor, and. This is awesome. And he can make a ton of money, which he did. Now, let's bring it a little closer to home. How is this business practice like what is done at a fire sale or at a foreclosure? Or by importing of Mexican workers to do farm work or meat packers? How is it similar to that? There's a similarity.
Take advantage of others to get yourself rich.
Well, now specifically taking advantage of others and who are in what situation?
Desperation.
Right. Basically, capitalizing on people's absolute desperation. A person's having a fire sale. They literally had a fire and they have to get rid of goods. Or foreclosure, they in bad financial situation and you take advantage of it. Okay? Or Mexican workers who are coming in to work, whether they be legal or illegal, come in to pick the various fruits and vegetables, or work in the meat. Now, they're willing to take these sometimes below even minimum wage prices because it's still more they're going to make in Mexico or in other Nicaragua or Venezuela, whatever place they came from. So, but basically, they're willing to work at cut rate prices and live basically in squalor in whether dormitories or very bad locations because they're absolutely desperate.
I mean, it's a that's a big jump.
Dead.
Mexican labor to Jewish war slaves.
So, I didn't say it's identical, but there's a similarity. In other words, Oskar Schindler built a factory because he could get, at that time, very cheap labor. Now, obviously, became free labor, but they're basically desperate people, and people were begging him to be part of his factory because being a part of his factory mean basically you didn't get killed. So, and initially, he had no care or concern for the health and well-being of Jews. He was a member of the Nazi Party. He wasn't an ideologue in the sense. He wanted to make money. So these are people who are desperate. Well, take advantage of him. And he made tons of money that way. Okay? Now, how did this member of the Nazi Party save 1,200 Jews from certain death? How did he do it? Could somebody bring out some of the details? Very clever. What were some of the clever things he did?
He paid off the people that were sending people to death camps or to work camps.
Yes. So he was based now. So how did he get involved with these people? And how did he work it out? He was extremely shrewd.
He was a very charismatic person.
Yes.
And he knew that people were. He could, play off people's greed.
Yes.
And pay people under the table, give them champagne, money, goods, that they couldn't get, during the war.
Luxury items.
And they didn't really care. They just wanted the goods and the money. So, they'll send people wherever you would tell them to do
it. Right, exactly. In other words, for them, Jews were like worthless, so... They'll just if they have to bring a certain quota to the death camps or to a thing, they'll get somebody else. And this guy's paying me top dollar to divert his workers. Then it's awesome. Correct. Liam Neeson did an exquisite job of, playing the charismatic schmoozing guy, working over all the. And befriending all the SS
top
leadership, the top mockers, and just spreading the money around and drinks and on me and gold and watches and diamonds, just everything. And then, so therefore, he got his people, and then he just starts paying everybody off. And initially, he was paying them off. Go ahead.
He had another strategy, which was not seen in this particular clip. But he was trying to justify why he had to keep each one of those because it was helping the German war effort. So whether it was a kid that he needed to get their little tiny fingers into something to finish a job, he found excuses to tell the Nazis that these were essential workers who had training and he was not going to lose his value in all the training or their abilities. And that's why, again, he would justify that the kids were needed on the production line for the weapons.
Exactly, right. So he was extremely clever of making up all kinds of, crazy excuses to get people in. A one-armed guy, whatever. He had all kinds of ways to keep his people in. Now, here's a key part of the movie. What realization and transformations must have occurred within him to do the dangerous things he did to save so many Jews? Because if he got discovered that he's bribing everybody and he's really doing it to preserve Jews... He would have been executed in 5 seconds. And he did it for years. What must have occurred within him that decided, because he's the only member of the Nazi Party that used his wealth and influence to save Jews. There were thousands of other Gentiles, members of the Nazi Party, that could have used their influence to save people, but did not. He's the one. He's the guy.
Well, he ended up penniless, right?
Yes, he did.
So it's one of those things is that he ended up throughout, but he had to pay basically per person he was saying was essential, right? And there's that famous scene in the movie, right, where he takes off his watch to offer that up as his last payment because he's like basically run out of money, but he's still trying to save people. So it's like he used his last dollar and ended up penniless in order to save people. So that's kind of the situation of why he's like held in high regard.
Correct. But what do you think, and I think the movie does a decent job of depicting his evolution, which is a 3-hour, 15-minute movie. What must have occurred within him that he would make that decision when literally thousands, if not millions, of Nazis and collaborators did not?
Human life is worth more than money.
Yeah, but what?
Well, I think the whole idea is that there's nothing special about him, right? Is that he was just someone who decided to make the right decision, right? Like, there wasn't any, it wasn't like he grew up with, like, a Jewish uncle or, like, someone right. who was in his family that he knew. He was just someone who decided to do what they could, right? So I think that's also one of the things is he's just a common guy who decided.
And he saw human beings being treated not like human beings.
Right, but right. so many, in a certain sense, I'm asking you a question that in a certain sense we cannot answer. In other words, why were so many Nazis did not make his decision, but he saw the injustice and said, you know, basically came to the decision that life is not worth living if I'm going to be a tool in the Hitler's death machine. Now,
could it be that he had a sense of influence and power that he could use and utilize where maybe other Nazis did not, and they were scared that if they helped, they would be killed, or I don't know.
He was vulnerable like any person who he wasn't a general. I mean, he was a guy who had who was a profiteering person, as Marvin said before, owned a bunch of factories. And was able to duplicitously use his skill set, his certain set of skills of flattery and bribery to save these Jews. And I didn't show you the last scene where the Jews, when he has to leave because the war is over and he has to flee, and they give him an affidavit saying he's not a murderer, he's a not member of the Nazi Party, but he saved 1,200 Jews. He has them that thing, and then they give him a ring. Does anybody remember what the ring says? This is a statement from the Talmud. Anybody remember what it said on that ring?
I can only speculate something. Could it be the expression of saving one life, saving the world kind of thing? Or
that, Marvin, you are on the point. Whoever saves one person, as if he saves an entire world. And they engraved that in the inner part of the ring. And then he drops the ring. He looks, scrambles to get it and put it on. He says, but I have the car. I could have got 10 more people. And I have this gold Nazi membership pin. I could have got maybe one or two more people. And instead of saying how great he feels that he saved 1,200 people, said, I threw away so much money, I could have saved so many more people. He just felt devastated. So, go ahead, Adrian.
Just to play the devil's advocate here, is there a possibility that he might not be as virtuous as we think he is?
In what sense?
Maybe it was a narcissistic thing that was driving him, and or whether it wasn't really an ethic, something that he thought was right, but rather something that he felt was right, because he just connected with the workers and started developing a certain empathy for what they were going through, and maybe just acting on that emotional impulse of empathy and or narcissism. Maybe that was it, and not like a developed cognition of right and wrong.
I mean, he didn't get recognized until he was had already passed, basically.
Well, he came to he was recognized in 1962 in Israel, But basically, he was. But as you mentioned, after the war, he had a lot of failures in businesses, and he was supported by a number of the survivors who had gratitude toward him. He had a very difficult circumstance. But again, Adrian, he was a guy who was like, he was a womanizer, he was a profiteering guy. He's not a great philosopher, and he's not, in fact, even left his wife after the war because he became bankrupt. You know, he's not a simple person. You know, he's not an angelic person, but there was a basic sometimes a person can have in a very foundational sense, this is wrong, and I can't be that person that does this, that does that, looks the other way and has all these people murdered. He just had
For better or worse, he also wasn't in a position to completely ignore it, right? So if you're like a business person working in the city, working in an office, right, they have this ability to just pretend where the labor is coming from, right?
Yes.
To pretend that people aren't dying. But his factories were bringing in people from the camps, you know, and he's spending time at the camps. So he can't have a blind eye to it the way a lot of people are able to.
That's true. But so many other people, but Sarah, so many other people had that same knowledge and basically did nothing.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm not stating that, but I'm saying it's also, you know, it's not like he didn't know what was going on. Like,
yes, he knew, correct.
Tried to just pretend it wasn't happening.
Sarah, 100% correct. He was, he could not deny he had a sort of a front row seat on the Nazi brutality. Let me share a shocking fact that I only learned this particular year. You know, there was about before the Nazis came to Poland, there were around 3.3 or 3.5 million Jews. 3 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust from Poland. And the other 300,000 or 300,000-400,000, the ones that survived, the majority of them were taken, captured by the Soviets and taken to, you know, one of the Gulag, etc., or to Soviet camps. The ones that remained in Poland, in all of Poland through the war, either they survived in the camps or in hiding, numbered less than 35,000. Out of the 3.5 million Jews, if you were Polish Jew and you did not get to the, you did not escape to the Soviets, which was, by the way, vacation. If you were in Poland, they mostly all perished, except for 35,000. It's just amazing.
And the ones who went back, some of them faced a program. I think it was called Kielce.
Yes, it's another terrible circumstance that a number of Jews that came back to find their houses, their property, etc. after the war, got welcomed by, oh, you lived and you survived, and there was a pogrom and more Jews died. Can you imagine that? You're a Holocaust survivor and you get back to the thing, and then you're killed by the Polish.
Neighbors.
It's unbelievable. Okay, so I bring this introduction, this very real sense of things, there's a short in the first chapter of Shemot deals about the new king arose in Egypt who enslaves the Jews. And there was a particular episode in his program to enslave and control the Jews. We're going to analyze that, but with the perspective of Schindler's List, I think have a new perspective. So without further ado, let's learn that little piece here. I'm going to turn. Okay, so let's go to the sheet for a moment. Okay, let me call upon who would like to read. Any volunteers? All right, Shana, quick on the draw. Excellent.
The king of Egypt spoke to the chief midwives of the Hebrews, whose names were Shifra and Puah. He said, when you deliver Hebrew women, you must look carefully at the birth stool. If the infant is a boy, kill it. But if it is a girl, let it live. The midwives feared God and did not do as the Egyptian king had ordered them. They allowed the infant boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and demanded, "Why did you do this? You let the infant boys live." "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptians," replied the midwives to Pharaoh. "They know how to deliver. They can give birth before a midwife even gets to them." God was good to the midwives, and the people increased and became very numerous. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them great families of their own. Pharaoh then gave orders to all his people. Every boy who was born must be cast into the Nile, but every girl should be allowed to live.
Okay, so this is the famous episode of... This was after there were essentially four phases of the enslavement. Phase one was a work tax for foreign workers. So if you were Jewish and you could not pay the tax, you had to work it off. So according to the Ramban, at least, if you were wealthy and you could pay the tax, you didn't have to work. From that perspective, wealthy Jews did not get enslaved, okay? Step two, then he added far a greater measure of servitude to the people who are working, really crushing labor. But then Paro got, was upset because the Jews were continuing to grow in size as a nation, causing more fear and panic. And he had to do something radical. This is step three. Step three in the thing was bring in the chief midwives and basically talk about a plan of covert genocide. Your job is like this. The woman comes in labor. You have a certain position and the baby comes out. And basically, the idea was, if it's a boy, what is he asking them to do? Basically, just twist his neck, and there's a certain percentage of children, babies that are certainly in the ancient world, even not the ancient world, even to relatively modern times, that were born stillborn, or died in childbirth. That was a very common thing, and therefore people could ascribe, terrible thing, your baby's not responding. But that's what he wanted to do, a covert plan of infanticide, killing all the boys, okay? So by the way, we've had classes in the past comparing, contrasting Hitler and Paro. There are comparisons. This one, by the way, is a pretty clear one, okay? Hitler does not want the Jews, he wants to control them. Initially, he came to the nations of the world, take our Jews, we'll even send them out in luxury liners. And only two countries would take the Jews. The Dominican Republic, and I think Cuba. And England said they would take 100,000 children, called the Kinder Transport. Everybody else said, no, we have our quotas, we're not taking the Jews. And once Hitler saw that, he says, they don't really care. I can do what the hell I want. And tragically, he did. So Paro is still concerned about public opinion. That's why he's doing it covertly, right? He has he thinks his willing executioners, i.e. these midwives. But so what happens? What do these midwives do? Suzanne, what do the midwives do?
They said the Hebrew women they're too good at delivering babies. We can't catch them in time. We can't catch the boys in time.
Right. So basically, they lied to him. They said basically, these kids, we couldn't get the job done because we show up for the delivery. These mothers deliver their own kids, and that's it.
No.
That's it. So they basically lied. Now, there's an ambiguity here, which I don't know you caught, but I'll ask the question. This is an interesting point. Were Shifra and Pua midwives of the Jews or Jewish midwives?
I mean, I would assume that they were
Jewish midwives, but that could be a bad assumption.
No, so what would be reasons you would think it would be Jewish, and what would you be think that they would not be Jewish? Give me reasons, because it says the word La Mieldo Ta Ivriot, which does mean the Jewish midwives, but it could be an anomaly, could be the midwives of the Jews. You could be an anomalous grammatical form, or maybe slightly vocalized slightly differently.
I mean, I would think that they were Jews just because if they were slave labor, I would assume that midwives wouldn't, the normal Egyptian midwives wouldn't be the midwives for the slave labor. But at the same time, these midwives have an audience with Paro. So that would make me assume that they're not Jewish.
Right, but they say that these Jewish women, right? So for me, the thing that always gets me is when they say, like, well, you know, these Jewish women aren't like Egyptian women.
Right.
Right? They have children on their own before we even get there. That's always, to me, like, the little of, like, are you're basically separating yourself from the Hebrew women by saying these.
Exactly. Good point. So that's, so a support for the somewhat ambiguous circumstance, as Sarah is saying, is that since they say, well, these Hebrew women are not like the Egyptians, now that could be that they're talking about not themselves. You can, as we're going to see from a commentator, which we've not done too many times, the Abarbanel, who lived in the 1500s, who was, in addition to being a great biblical commentary, leader of the Jewish people, was King Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain's minister of finance. And unfortunately, after the Inquisition in 1492, left, even though he was offered to stay in Spain because he was doing such a great job as a finance minister. A fun fact, sidebar, Bibi Netanyahu's father, Professor Bibi Netanyahu, wrote an amazing biography of the Abarbanel. And one of the interesting things he did was that the Abarbanel was the Jewish leader of the Jews of Spain. He did not want to leave them. So he had to, they said, you can leave. We won't force convert you, but you're leaving your money here. So he and his family walked out of Spain, and they were very wealthy, leaving all their assets behind. And what happened was they were on a boat, and nobody would take them. Sounds familiar? Boats in the Mediterranean, and they couldn't port anywhere, and they're starving. There was a small duchy on the Italian coast. This guy had a problem. His economy is bust. What does he do? Bring in the Jews. Now, again, the non-Jews did not do any borrowing and lending with interest. Jews did. And he made that country wealthy, and again he became wealthy. And what happened when this happened many times? What happened when the Jews were wealthy and they owed a lot, and the Christians owed a lot of money to them? What did the Christians do? Anybody, any guess?
Kick them out.
Kick them out, but very important. And all your loans are canceled. Clean the slate, and we're taking your money. So the Abarbanel made and lost four fortunes in his life and being part of the leader of the Jewish community. But and while doing all that, he wrote an extensive commentary on all of Tanakh and other plus interesting books of philosophy. So
it was free time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and dealing with being the leader of the Jewish people while they're going through some of the horrible, most horrible circumstance that faced the Jewish people in the medieval times. Okay, so he wrote a comment. Here's the deal. So Rashi, representing the dominant position, says Shifra is Yocheved. Who's Yocheved for 500 points in the square?
Moshe's mother.
Moshe's mother's correct. But her name is Shifra. Oh, the name comes from her taking care of Mishaperet of the infant. So it's not her name, but rather it's a sort of an adjective. Okay? Who's Pua? It's Miriam.
Sister.
Who's Miriam in this context?
Sister.
It's his sister.
It's Moshe's sister. Okay? So Rashi's viewing the the Shifra and Pua, the two chief midwives of the Midwife Association, is Moshe's mom and Moshe's sister.
Obviously, a mother-daughter combo?
A mother-daughter combo, right. Now, it could very well be, his argument would be like this. To do such a speak truth to power and basically lie and put your life on the line against Paro is somebody who's going to be very special. That's not going to be the average person. So, midrashically associating with them, the Shifra and Pua is really Yocheved and Miriam, is sort of like a consolidation. Like, you don't have to assume that all these people were, amazing people. So, that Moshe's mother and sister were willing to put their necks on the line to save the Jewish people. But Don Isaac Abarbanel doesn't agree. Let me hear somebody. Let me hear Adrian. Read it out. Don Isaac Abarbanel.
In English, Hebrew, or Spanish?
Well, yeah. We're gonna go with English. Well, I don't have the Spanish translation. He did know Spanish, obviously. He grew up in Spain. Go on.
They are not. Did you write this in Hebrew?
Yes, this is the English translation.
They were not Hebrews, since how could Pharaoh's mind be confident that a Hebrew woman would murder their own people's babies? ! Rather, they are midwives of the Hebrews, i.e., they assist the Hebrew woman in the birthing process. Just as the next verse says, when you deliver the Hebrew woman.
Aha. Uh-huh. So he says, he argues that basically, if Paro is trying to bring in a covert operation to basically murder babies, what is the likelihood that he's going to have Jewish women doing that, murdering their neighbors' babies as they deliver? He views it as a very low probability.
Isn't there an interpretation, though, that they disguise themselves, basically? Like, it is them, but they pretend to not be.
Pretend to not be what? Not to pretend to pretend to not
pretend
be Jews.
Pretend to not be Jews.
There is a third possibility, which I did not bring down, which is that they were not Jewish. They converted. So therefore, they had the trust of Paro because he was unaware of their Jewish identity. But they were Jews. That's what it says when they says the phrase, but the midwives feared God. So you can learn that two ways. Either A, they feared God because they had commitment to the ways of Avram, just like the other Jews. Or they feared God in a general moral sense, that I'm not going to be a person murdering babies. Okay, there's two ways you can read that.
Well, Rabbi, but if you're going to learn it's Shifra and Pua.
No, everybody knows. No, Shifra, so that's their Jews.
That's clear.
Yeah, Shifra, okay. If you say Shifra and Pua, you'll let Yocheved and Miriam, they're Jews. Now, what is that really? We had another example from the Holocaust. What did Paro really want them to become from the Holocaust? If there were two Jewish women in charge?
What's the word for it? Kapos?
Exactly right, kapos. All right, who can explain what happened with the kapos?
Well, they were assigned in the concentration camps. They were Jews that were in charge of sort of doing, like, being on the ground and being in charge of what was happening within their legions that they were assigned to. And they basically ended up being equally, if not worse, than the concentration camp guards.
Yes.
That's what ended up happening.
Exactly. In other words, the Nazis, part of their genius, they were geniuses in many things, was psychological warfare. They would take a group of people, the leaders, and say, we'll let you live. We'll give you small advantages. We'll give you extra food. You have to do our bidding. And therefore, it worked out that the capos were sometimes more vicious in order just to save...
They were more vested. They had more skin in the game.
Right. Than the Nazis. So basically, what Paro was basically doing to them when he brought in Shifra and Pua, if you take the Rashi shot, that they were two Jewish women, two Jewish administrators, says he basically gave them an offer you cannot refuse. Because basically, the implied point, if you don't listen to what Paro has to say, what is the consequence in the ancient world?
Death.
Yeah, but not just death. First, we're going to torture you, then we're going to kill you. Okay, it would have been something horrible. Okay, nobody does brutality like the ancient world. Okay, so the Romans, of course, and the Egyptians were no tzaddikim either. So basically, you have to understand how whether it be Jews or non-Jews, what they are basically told, you got to listen to Paro to get his plan done and do it covertly, because if you're not going to do it, he's going to kill you. These women had the guts to basically create a ruse, which is very, of course, which is my question number 6. How is Shifra and Pua saving the babies from Paro comparable to Schindler saving the Jews from the Nazis? There's a beautiful comparison there. What's the comparison?
It depends on what your assumption is of whether they were Jewish or not.
Either way. I don't think it makes a difference in essence.
I mean, in both cases, if we're assuming they're not Jewish, right, it's non-Jews using their ability to persuade, manipulate, and stand up, right, in order to save Jewish lives.
That's if you say, but if they're non-Jews, let's say the Schindler and Pua were not Jewish women, just like Schindler.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. All right, or let's say they're Jewish. Still, they're standing up to power. They're using their God-given whether it be lying, deception, basically able to pull off a deception on Paro that he would not. He didn't kill them. It's interesting, but they basically, just like Schindler, basically had the following proposition. Life is not worth living if I am either a murderer or accomplice to a murder. It's just not worth. I'm not going to do it, and I'll do what I can to A, protect the innocent, and B, make sure I don't get killed in the process. That's why Schindler is a big tzaddik. That's why he's rightfully buried in Hartzion. The guy, it was not just he did it for 5 minutes. He did this for a prolonged period of time, years. Okay. Now let's break it down. What are the elements of their heroism? Let's break down. Let's sort of dissect. What are all the elements of their heroism? And B, is the act more heroic if Shifra and Pua are Jewish or non-Jewish? What are the elements of the heroism
non-Jewish?
Here? Well, let's break it down. What were the elements of their heroism? Let's break it down. What are the elements here?
They put their lives in danger for other people.
Yes. A. B. What else?
They sacrifice their, standing in society, I guess. Like, they could have lost their homes or their livelihoods.
Well, they could have lost their lives. And they also brought, they had tremendous courage. In other words, to stand there in front of Paro and present basically a huge lie, okay? They lied their tuchuses off to the guy. We show up. We couldn't believe it. These Jewish women, they deliver themselves. We couldn't do it. We wanted to do it. We couldn't do it. It's crazy. You know what I'm saying? They had to get like Academy Award winning presentations to pull off the lie, because Paro does not persecute them. He didn't say, you're liars, you're scamming me. He believed them. It's amazing. All right, so to be graceful under fire, to have everything on the line, to speak truth to power, and to do it, it's just amazing. Now, here's more. This is my question to you all, and we'll go. We'll do a quick raise hand thing. Is the act more heroic if Schiffer and Poole are Jewish or non-Jewish? If you think it was more heroic if they were Jewish, raise your hand. If it's more heroic if they're not Jewish, raise your hand. If you're not sure, raise your hand. Okay, so. Now, the overwhelming winner tonight is that if Schiffer and Poole are not Jewish, that's more heroic. Please tell me why you think that is. All right, Alan, then Scott. Alan and Scott.
I mean, I think it's harder to sometimes have compassion for people in other groups because you don't identify with them. So I think it takes either your eyes being open or extra level of compassion to look at other people with kindness and kind of going outside of your own sphere of people to help someone else.
Huge. All right, Scott, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that if they were both Jewish, it'd be like, oh, okay, like, you know, they're both Jewish. Of course, they're going to do the right thing to save these babies, but it's more if they're not Jewish and they're just doing it, you know, just to save lives, to help people.
Right, it's very similar to Alan. They're not saving somebody in their own, if it's part of people in their own group, it's natural to save people that you identify with, that are part of your mishpacha.
Right, that you share something
You with. Share a commonality with, but these people have nothing to do with it. They should, in other words, but, you know, they should have just done it. Because they, you know, their boss, i.e. Paro, said to do it. That's another thing. In other
they
words,
just knew it was wrong. Yeah.
Even if they know it's wrong, in other words, how is it so easy if you're loyal to the leader? Like in this case, they're loyal to Paro. There's no reason to assume they're not loyal people. But then he asks them to do something that they find absolutely morally, absolutely disgraceful. To stand up to the leader, is that an easy thing?
No, it's very hard.
It's very hard. So,
make the case for the opposite side?
Go ahead. So, we call Adrian, our legal defense to say that it's greater level if Schiffer and Poole are Jewish. Go ahead. You got the floor.
Well, you got to think of what the impetus is, what the motivation is behind the act. And if you're a Jewish woman, basically, you know, you're doing so out of necessity because, you know, your own children might be at peril. Whereas if you're a Gentile, you do so because you ideologically believe in it. And I find that when you're ideologically persuaded by something such as, you know, this is morally reprehensible, it might be less of a anxiety and fear standing before Pharaoh and lying, because they're doing so because they really believe in it. Whereas the Jewish woman, they might be acting out of fear. And to be able to stand there and hold a straight face despite the very strong emotions that they might be experiencing, but to be able to, you know, nonetheless, you know, do the right thing and take charge of their reptilian brain, which was probably on fire, might be a little more praiseworthy. And someone who's a radical ideal, not radical, but is ideologically persuaded to such an extent that they will put their lives in danger for someone who they're not even related to. I would say that those people, they're so persuaded in their minds that it might not have been an emotional issue for them.
Okay. So you're arguing that if they were non-Jews, they had to be sort of like ideological zealots to do it. And that's not, even though it's stressful, it's not as stressful as a Jewish slave woman who is doing it based upon identification. Okay. All right, Alan.
I mean, Adrian, I see where you're going with that, but I also think about the fundamental that, like, we all were created by Hashem, and, you know, there are the sects of Gentiles that follow the Noah covenant, that I feel like, you know, you can't just kind of blanket it as zealots, but we all have that kind of, I don't know, something inside that prompts us to do the right thing or to question it, you know, whether it be your conscience or whether it be Hashem, just because we all come from Noah, you know, like we all, so I see what you're saying, but I also think maybe there was something inside of them that said, hey, this is the right thing to do, regardless of what Pharaoh had said.
Okay.
I didn't really make a point as to the merits. I was more alluding to what was more challenging.
Fair.
Right. So whether you think that it was more heroic if they'd be Jewish or not Jewish, we both agree that what they did was, I mean, again, like Schindler, you know, and this thing, by the way, this program wasn't one afternoon. No doubt they had to go to Paro a number of times. This was over a period of time. You know what I'm saying? This wasn't a one presentation and you're, you know, one and done. Okay? This is just simply frightful. Okay, now to fully explore the idea, I created three scenarios to bring out the idea. Here's scenario number one. Debbie, and this is basically, I got this question sent to me on my Halacha chat back in March. So I'll change the people. Debbie and Steve have a wonderful nanny, Claudia, for their son, Jeffrey. She arrives promptly every morning at 7:30 so they can both get to work on time. Her weekly rate is very reasonable as her immigration situation is not settled. They do not think about the circumstance that causes this reasonable rate. When COVID hit in March 2020, they were confronted with a question. How long should they keep paying Claudia if she cannot come to work? What should they do? What do you guys say?
So I actually have this experience in real life.
Yes.
Which is that, you know, our housekeeper from Miami, you know, basically when my younger siblings graduated from high school, she was not really needed as much in the house. And she immigrated back to Chile, which is where she lives, and she is struggling to make ends meet. And so an issue that I myself and my family had to contend with is, you know, should we continue paying her even though she's no longer providing any services for us?
Right. So that's even a more extreme thing, because here, the couple, which had usually gone out to work, the office, as you know, all the offices got shut down in March, April. They, not only that, they could not have, they really would have liked to have Claudia over to help with little Jeffrey. Jeffrey's running around because Jeffrey can't go anywhere. Jeffrey's at home. But because of COVID, as you remember, nobody was having anybody over in the house for months, right? So what should they do? What are the issues here?
Well, I can talk that a little bit. I would say that if they are both working still, even if it's from home, and they are making money, then they should continue to pay her. One, because if she's a good employee, they should want to keep her when things go back. And you don't know at that point in time when you're going to be going back to work.
Okay, good.
So you want to keep her for your own interest, but then at the same time, you have the compassion that particularly if you are able to afford it still, the fact is she doesn't have much else to go to given the circumstances. So I think the morally correct thing is to continue paying. And as somebody who is an employer and has been in this kind of situation, I have done things to assist where I can in this situation, even though I myself am greatly impacted by the restrictions on the type of business that I run. So I've had that kind of scenario, and I try and do my best in whatever framework I can do to make sure that people are taken care of as best I can.
Marvin, that is exactly correct. So I asked Diane, a judge of financial matters, Posek, Professor Rabbi Michael Broyd, and he said, insofar as there's in halacha, when it comes to financial matters, there's a halachic minimum. What is the minimalistic thing that you're not stealing or mistreating your employee? And that would be going based upon what is in general when there is a no work, no fault situation where the person can't keep on working. What is the common accepted, you know, practice in the industry? You go by industry, okay? So whatever that would be, is that 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 10, whatever that number is, whatever the American standard would be, and that would be the assumption of how you got into business with that person, and that would be your halachic minimum. But then he said, this person is poor. They are working as a nanny, you know, because they don't have, as Marvin so eloquently said, they don't have a lot going on financially. If you're not going to pay them, they're going to be completely destitute. If you can do it, if you are still working, you should pay them as long as you can. That's the right thing to do. We are the mark of the Jew is we are Rachmanim, B'nai Rachmanim. We are compassionate people, sons of compassionate people. And if you had the financial wherewithal to do it, you should do it. And that's what I told the couple. I myself...
By the way, this is like the number one hot topic out here in Bergen County on all the moms groups when the pandemic hit. What do we do? Right? We can't let our cleaning ladies in. We can't let... We're not sure if the nanny should be coming back and forth. You know, financially, what do we do? Like, and, you know, based on different circumstances. Right? And... You know, when it was supposed to be 2 weeks, okay, obviously just still pay them, right? And then it became 2 months and 6 months, right? And like right. Continually, this is the continual topic that keeps happening.
Right.
So this still goes on.
Correct. So there's sort of a halachic minimum, and then there is a baal tzedakah, baal chesed maximum. Our family, we had a person, a cleaning lady came in weekly. We paid him through the entire time. We were, you know, my wife and I are still working, so we did that.
We still paid ours for, we eventually let her come after about 2 months. She started coming with a mask on. So, but we paid her until she came back.
Right. That's the right thing to do. And 'cause again, the person's in a desperate circumstance. And we have to have rachmanis. We have to have compassion. Okay, scenario number two. You are stuck in an important meeting on a Friday afternoon with your boss and the company's largest client. The clock is ticking. You are feeling you will not get home in time for Shabbos unless you excuse yourself right now. The deal is so important to the company. A bead of sweat goes down your back. You stand up and tell them, you want to stand up and tell them that you are a Shabbos observant Jew and leave. What should you do?
You should have planned ahead. Sorry.
Okay, fine. But
you
can't always do that. Sometimes, I don't know about you, but I work for the Orthodox Union. They use the Outlook system of meeting invitations. There are certain people who I get a meeting invitation. It's up to me. I could accept. I could decline. I could reschedule. But there are certain people who are senior to me. If they say, I want to meet at this time, there's only one acceptable response. I mean, unless my leg is on fire, accept. And I think anybody who...
I'm going to go with you being at the OU. It's less of an issue than some other
people. No, you're right. Correct. You're... So, Sarah, in regards...
I had an issue where I had... So I was on a remote call that I literally stayed in on until the minute of lighting, and then had to mentally figure out if it was okay for my manager to take over for me because they were Jewish, right. But they were in California. So in theory, they were fine.
Right.
So, I mean, I've played this game. Luckily, remote makes it a little easier.
Yes,
right?
It does.
But in general, you make another excuse. You don't say it's because you have to leave for Shabbos.
And Rabbi Pinney, I'll tell you, in my industry, as I'm about to click off, we get suicide threats Friday afternoon. It's huge.
Oh, lovely.
So
have life over anything else.
Well, right. So, no, obviously, if you are dealing with a medical emergency, that overrides Shabbos.
Right.
Somebody is that important in the
company.
What
if it's like a situation where you might lose your job?
He's usually known as a Shabbos observer already, and he can definitely stick up for Sabbath.
Suzanne, you got a lot of background. Suzanne, you have a lot of background.
I was saying, if somebody is that big and important in the company, and he's on with the boss and the largest client, he's usually, at that point, known already he's a Shabbos observer, and they respect him for it. So he should have been out 10 minutes earlier, or at that moment he has to be out no later. It's his own boundary issue. There's numerous stories with Ben Brofman, P. Diddy calling him on Shabbos, or after candlelighting.
Yeah, actually, there's some really funny ones about that.
It was actually, he apologized afterwards to not pick up, because he didn't pick up. And he said, "You better right. I made money off you not picking."
Yeah, he bet his friend that I wouldn't pick up, and he made $10,000 off the bet.
You know what I'm saying? So people know in Hollywood. I mean, what's his name?
Mm-hmm.
Steve, what's his name from the Upper West Side? What's his name? He's in Hollywood. He's one of the biggest attorneys in Warner Brothers. Everybody knows who he is. As far as
it gets a little more difficult when you're not that. Famous.
Right. So you're right.
No,
if you're not a senior person, company, he's with his boss and the client.
No, but
they know how big it is.
No,
I'm
trying to create a scenario where basically the whole shear has been about where life will unfold in a way where some of your dearest values are being challenged. We started with life and death.
You are taking it to that point, but that's the point. It's a value in today's society. A person can be respected. Everybody knows it's Friday afternoon, except a suicide situation. The deal can close Monday morning. You don't leave things for Friday. It's the same idea.
I want to tell you, first of all, Chaim, that may be true, but first of all, there are two situations. People who are, A, not so senior, and therefore they feel that the economic situation is tenuous. They really need the job. They do not want to make waves. It's a COVID situation. The unemployment rate is very high, and they maybe they had a long term coming off a long term unemployment. They just cannot lose this job. I've had situations calling up. I'll give you another case. Maisa Shaya.
Are you saying it's okay?
If that's the case, then yeah, I would give whoever was said earlier, get off the earth excuse. That's it.
I'm creating.
What do you say? Making up an excuse, Rabbi?
I have done it before with, I have a previous engagement. I have a conflict. Without mentioning anything religious, but you are right. I am in a situation where I pretty much am pretty job secure, right? I can do that and nobody's going to fire me over it.
Why would you use something that's not the religious card? You use the religious card, you got fired, you then sue them for employment discrimination.
The only reason my husband still has his job is the union. Because in theory, he should have been forced to work multiple Shabbos, multiple Yom Tov.
Yeah, but Shabbos observer, by the way, does not mean they can't fire you. For example,
we need a guy who's there until 7 o'clock.
Right, in other words, there could be certain industries where your presence is critical, and they could say it's not. If it's mission critical, it's not. They could fire you because this is a mission critical job. Most of our business is this time. We need a manager or a supervisor here on the floor, and that's it. It's non-negotiable. you know, they don't have to be Sabbath observant friendly in everything. That's not the true.
It's just better for a lawyer, an employment lawyer, to know that it had to do something with religion. It's just,
well, yeah, but I also didn't take a job because I knew that I was going to have to do that on Shabbos. That every Shabbos was going to be a decision, right? Of is it okay? Is it not okay? Because it was going to be leading clinical trials for heart attacks, basically, right? Heart attacks are not scheduled, right? But I'm not a doctor. So I don't technically have to be there, but in order for them to do investigational treatment, they need somebody who knows the investigational regulations, right? So, you know, there are that. I made the decision to take a different job, even though I don't love it as much, but because I knew that situation was going to happen probably every weekend.
Right. That's okay. Excellent. Now, a very common thing, I'll move on to our next care. There are many MGEers that became Shabbat observant in the middle of a career in a particular job, and they did not want to bring it up mid-career. They, by the way, speak to your boss, I've become Sabbath observant. They didn't want to deal with the confrontation. I can't step into their shoes. And they rather left that job, took a new job, and then in their onboarding, they said, I am Sabbath observant, and then during the winter time, I'm going to have to leave early on Fridays. So I'm just saying, what you would do, I'm not asking you what you do, I'm just saying that this is a very high-tense situation. I've had a situation where a person was part of a currency training situation, and he had to sort of do a special locking of the whole, all the transactions, which, of course, in the wintertime, it had to be at 5 o'clock, which, of course, is, even right now, well into Shabbos. And he could not give it over to an inferior, or to a subordinate. And if he did, he could get fired. Anyways, kind of long story short, he got terminated, and it was because of Shabbos. So I'm just saying, I'm not here to tell you the fairy tales, and you keep Shabbos, and everything works out well. Now, he has a good life. The job did not work out. The bottom line is. So I don't want to minimize that. The purpose of this scenario is to let you know that in your life, your core values will be tested. Won't be tested on the, God willing, not on the Oscar Schindler level or the Jewish or non-Jewish midwives of the Jews, but this level is very common. And then I'll give you the last one before we wrap it up for tonight. This is also even more common. Here's the situation. You are a loyal employee of Mr. Jones. He has been there for you through thick and thin. The company has had a rough year during COVID. He asked you to describe the expense as a legitimate business tax deduction. It is, in fact, does not qualify as a legitimate business tax deduction. You and Mr. Jones know that. What do you do?
My dad had this exact issue, actually, and he had to drop the client.
Right. This is not uncommon. You are an accountant. You are a bookkeeper. You're in some part of financial services. And the boss wants you to massage, cook the books, work something out, so basically they can take a beneficial unearned tax deduction, which will save the company tens of thousands of dollars. And you are now being put on the spot. That, my friends, is not a simple, I'm not going to go around and ask you what you guys will do, because I know you're all going to tell me, Rabbi, for me, I would have stand up and look right into Mr. Jones' eyes and says, Mr. Jones, I would not do that. I'm a man of principle. I'm a woman of principle. I'm not doing that. I know you're going to say that. Of course you would.
This is such a big issue as a lawyer as well.
Lawyer, accountant, all the time.
I dealt with this issue today because I'm drafting a complaint, and I know that if I write something in the complaint, it's going to make it pass motion to dismiss into discovery, and basically my case will proceed, but I don't have the evidence to make the allegation.
that I want to make in the complaint, which is basically that the company engaged in blatant fraud. And I don't have the evidence to support that allegation. And I started going back and forth, you know. Do I allege upon information and believe when I really don't have any reason to any information or any belief? So I ended up putting a footnote on the complaint saying, you know, to the best of my client's knowledge, this is the case. However, she represents that she will withdraw the allegation if they share the information that would prove that they didn't engage in fraud. So I threw a footnote saying, like, if they share the information and it's not fraud, I will not pursue this allegation.
Okay.
That's how I resolved the
problem. All right, Alan, you had the last comment of the night. What's up?
I would say that it just depends on what the expenses were for, because the IRS allows certain number of dollars for development, and there's always a way around the tax law in order to use it for your advantage.
So again, I'm trying to create a construct where, you know, I understand that there is idea. I understand it's not a black and white line. There could be a, you could make the case
the
for what they call
more
aggressive. They call the way that an account will say
you're trying to present the moral case, and we're working our way out of it.
Right. It could be a more aggressive stance, but we're talking about a situation where it's basically straight out fraud. And then, what I'm talking about is, as Sarah pointed out, this is not something that is infrequently happened. As Adrian points out, these kind of moral challenges to live a Jewish life is to be challenged. You're going to be challenged, and your morals and values are going to be tested. Sometimes,
I think with it, it's just saying, like, you know, I'm not willing to take the risk of going to jail. You know, like,
okay, so you have a good answer.
I mean, the bigger issue becomes, right, when somebody who's religious or someone who you respect as a moral person is the person asking you to do it, right?
Correct.
Right.
Even more ugly. Yes. All right. So, I've hopefully given you guys something to think about for today. This is all coming from the Parsha. In life, we are going to be challenged. Some people tragically were challenged on the most epic level, like Oscar Schindler, and ultimately, you know, was it tzaddik? And some people like going to be like the midwives of the Jews, whether they were Jewish or not Jewish. We can debate that. Again, stood up to Paro. Extremely, unbelievably hard to imagine to do that. And did not engage in murder of babies. And then we have common situations, whether it be the moral question about taking care of the people who rely upon you who are poor, the nanny, the housekeeper, and to deal with in a just and proper way. Or whether it be that you are your commitment to Shabbos and observance is being challenged, or whether it be in the laws of money, the laws of financial matters, you're going to be challenged. There's no way around that, and that is the essence of a Jew, is to be able to step up to the plate, and at least you're not going to necessarily bat 1,000, but do the best that you can. All right, guys, something to think about. Have a great night. Lelotov.
Thanks, Rabbi.